You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Just got back from the Senate office buildings where I had this conversation with Senator Sherrod Brown. Senator Brown, David Vitter, Senator Vitter, is so politically opposite of you on so many issues. How did this thing come about, this coalition or this piece of legislation?
Well, I was sitting in banking committee one day, and we sit in a semicircle, and the Republicans sit across from the Democrats, and I listened to him question Secretary Geithner about capital standards, and realized he was pretty aggressive, and he was willing to say some things that I thought were a bit of a challenge to Wall Street, to the large 5, 6, 7 banks in Wall Street, and I just walked over and started talking to him. I said, I think we can work together in some of this. And I think that the skepticism that many progressives have about big banks and Wall Street is not too different from the skepticism people on the right have about government. And I think in this case, there's some overlap there that the regulators and Wall Street and the influence Wall Street has with the regulators, all of that combined does, in fact, put our economy, our whole financial system, puts Main Street at risk, and that's why I've been able to team up on this legislation.
Can you summarize this legislation?
Yeah, it does a number of things, but primarily it sets capital standards high enough, meaning banks have to hold equity as a 15% of their assets, and that means if the bank has a 7 or 8% drop in value because of some market forces or some mistakes they make, they still are protected against going under, against being unsustainable as a financial institution. And that's significantly higher than we've seen in the past. The second thing is, we've since Roosevelt built a safety net for banks, FDIC, the Federal Reserve, so that if there's a run on the bank, that the depositors are protected. That safety net shouldn't extend to the Wall Street traders. That's traders with a D, and should not extend to derivatives and credit default swaps. It should only be on traditional, what we used to call boring banking. That's where so it takes away that safety net by and large for those non-bank activities. And that means directly that these banks will not be engaged in the kind of risk they have been, because they're no longer getting this implicit subsidies the big banks get, because the market believes these banks are, in fact, too big to fail.
Does that mean that it is actually one step toward restoring Glass-Steagall or undoing Gramm-Leach-Bliley?
Prescriptively, it's not exactly Glass-Steagall. It's not Glass-Steagall, but it does say to these banks, you're not getting guarantees if you go outside regular banking.
Okay, so the commercial side is protected.
Correct.
The gambling side is not.
Yes, correct.
Now, I understand that right now big national banks have an advantage with regard to regulation and backstopping by the government that credit unions, small community banks, rural banks don't have, and that this bill seeks to fix that. Do I understand that correctly?
If you're an investor, you lend money to one of the Wall Street banks, you will lend to them, evidence shows, you'll lend them money at a rate of 50 basis points, 0.5%, 0.75%, maybe a 0.5% lower interest rates than you would lend to a community bank in Sycamore, Ohio, or Coldwater, Ohio, or to one of the big regionals in Columbus like Huntington, because the market understands that these large banks are too big to fail. So there is virtually no risk in your lending money to a Wall Street bank, because implicit in that is there is no risk, so you'll lend them money at lower cost. So they automatically, including according to Bloomberg, these largest six banks get about an $80 billion a year subsidy from taxpayers, from the government, implicitly in the form of lower interest rates on the capital markets.
Just because people assume that because the markets are assuming that there's less risk there, this is the moral hazard in reverse, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a moral hazard. That's a good way to say it. The market assumes there's virtually no risk because the government will bail them out. And look at what's happened to these banks. 20 years ago, the six largest banks in this country, had their combined assets were about 16, 17, 18% of GDP. Today, their combined assets are approaching 65% of GDP. So through because they get these subsidies, because of mergers and because of banks imploding and all that happened in 2007, 8, 9, 10, and since, you are seeing the big banks get larger and larger. The four biggest banks have increased their size by $2 trillion. The largest bank's assets are now, Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase are more than $2 trillion in assets. And, you know, it's not a question of economies of scale and efficiencies. You can be efficient at a $200, $300, or $400 billion bank, just as efficient. The size of these banks, it's the economic power they have when they're that big, and it's the political power. And you can see that in their reaction to the implementation of Dodd-Frank, and what's happened with the Volcker Rule and other rules that have not been finalized because of Wall Street lobbying.
Thomas Jefferson used the phrase, if overgrown wealth were to become a risk to the state, and then he called for essentially an inheritance tax. But, you know, that concept that excessive wealth can be a threat to the state, a threat to legislation, if these banks control over 60% of GDP or assets equal to over 60% of GDP, do you really think that you can get this through the Senate, that you and Senator Vitter?
I don't know. A year ago, I would have said no. When Senator Kaufman and I introduced legislation to break up the largest 5-6 banks back in 2010, we got 33-34 votes, including three Republicans. We're now working with 10 Republican offices. A number of Democrats who voted no on our amendment have said now they're going to vote yes. They've changed, and I think people in the Senate have seen the size of these banks and the economic and political power they have. It's not to say it's going to be easy. I think we have a shot at doing it. I've seen the public has changed. You see people like George Will and Thomas Hennig as a bank administrator, as a Federal Reserve administrator, and now at FDIC. You see a number of conservative regulators and columnists who now say these banks are too big to fail. This is a problem. We need to take away some of their guarantees and protections. They can either build more equity in their banks, or they can begin to divest some of their holdings in these big banks. Their choice.
And for our listeners or viewers who might want to reach out and support the work that you're doing, that you and Senator David Vitter are doing, actually, how do they do that?
Well, a number of ways. They can certainly to write and call and email their senators. Come on my website, sherrodbrown.com. You can help us with petitioning we're doing and other things. This is a sort of old Hubert Humphrey inside-outside strategy. I'm working my colleagues and working with outside groups and individuals online makes it a whole lot easier to put pressure on senators and congressmen to pay attention to this, that this issue isn't going away, that Wall Street money doesn't necessarily have to carry the day, and that citizen involvement really can matter on this issue.
Senator Brown, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
So this really is a big deal. I mean, you know, David Vitter and, you know, of all people, David Vitter, Senator Brown, I mean, these two political opposites. What this tells me and what it should tell you, and you ought to call Senator Brown's office and thank him for this and ask, you know, what else can I do to help? But what this tells me is that everybody, Republicans, Democrats, everybody gets it. That having banksters control an amount of money equal to 65% of the GDP of the entire country is a bad idea. That we need to do something about it. We need to do something about it fast. Meanwhile, these three young women who escaped today, or perhaps it was yesterday afternoon, from the home of this fellow who had kidnapped them for the last decade, I want to share with you Elizabeth Smart's thoughts. She was the young woman who was kidnapped and raped in Salt Lake City at the age of 14, held in captivity for 9 months, and how she felt that her abstinence-only education caused her to stay in bondage longer than she might otherwise have.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So from banks to abstinence only, actually in our third hour, we're going to get into what's called slut shaming with Annie Rose Strasser. Lots going on today. So, I guess there's kind of a segue here. We've got millions of Americans who have been economically raped by the banks. And You know, we talked earlier in the week, well, actually last week, I think it was, about how suicide rates are now going up, and the BBC study showing that suicides always follow conservative economic policies. And even though we have a Democratic president who has proposed, and you know, when Nancy Pelosi ran the House of Representatives, a lot of very, very good proposals to stimulate the economy, put people back to work, none of that happened because of Republicans in the Senate. The Republicans are absolutely preventing any of this. In fact, this report, austerity has cost the U.S. economy 2.2 million jobs. State, federal, and local governments have cut 500,000 jobs. In contrast, this is by Mark Gongloff in the Huffington Post. In contrast, in every other U.S. recession since 1970, in other words, you know, Nixon, Reagan, Bush, in every other U.S. recession, the government hired approximately 1.7 million people on average. That means that 2.2 million jobs were that many jobs in the hole. Okay, so rape is probably too strong a phrase to use for that, or the wrong metaphor. I was looking for a way to segue into this other story. Let me just change subjects. Good on Senator Brown for coming up with this legislation that will restrain the banks. Okay, we'll just put that in one category. B, Elizabeth Smart came out and was speaking. She was answering the question, you know, when she was the young girl who at the age of 14 was kidnapped and for 9 months held captive by this fellow and his wife and basically forced into a polygamous marriage with him, raped daily until she was rescued from her captors 9 months later. When she was rescued, she was walking down the street with this guy and his wife in a public place. And people were like, why weren't you screaming? And so she addressed that yesterday. And I think that this, we have no idea what the story is with why these three young women who were just released yesterday were 10 years in the, and the story is still coming out. So let's, you know, I'm not trying to draw parallels to that other than that it raises the topic. And Elizabeth Smart gave a speech yesterday. She was speaking at Johns Hopkins. And she said that in her abstinence-only education in school, one of her teachers had said that the reason why abstinence is the very best form of, you know, instead of talking about birth control or anything else, you should just say no. And the reason why is, according to her teacher, she told this story, that boys think of women who are not virgins the way they think of chewing gum. That's a weird kind of metaphor, but it stuck in her head. And she said, this is from, you know, Tara Culp Reisler, a wrestler writing this over at the Think Progress blog. This was in the Human Trafficking Forum at Johns Hopkins. She said, I thought, I'm quoting Elizabeth Smart now, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that chewed up piece of gum. Nobody rechews a piece of gum. You throw it away. And that's how easy it is to feel like you no longer have worth, you no longer have value. Why would it even be worth screaming out? Why would it even make a difference if you are rescued? Your life still has no value. This is how this young woman was thinking as a consequence of an abstinence-only education. Having been told, you know, that the rationale for an abstinence-only education is that, well, if you're no longer a virgin, you know, once you've had sex with somebody, there are people who will have no interest in you. The abstinence-only men have no interest in non-abstinence-only women, and abstinence, which, by the way, is a, well, it may be true for 1/1000th of 1% of the men out there, but I would say by and large, it's a joke. Joke is the wrong word. It's a lie. But here we're seeing, yeah, I mean, we already know the damage that abstinence-only education does in the, I think there's only one state now that has mandated it. Isn't it Louisiana or Alabama? There's one of our states that has mandated abstinence-only education. And it was... Oh, this is interesting. In a high school in West Virginia recently made national headlines after hosting a conservative religious speaker who told the students, if you take birth control, your mother probably hates you. And I could look at any one of you in the eyes right now and tell you if you're going to be promiscuous. Right. I mean, this is just this weird, this whole, you know, shame-based approach to sex that is setting up these young women to be, well, I would say that they're, I was going to say to be victims, but I would say that they are the victims of this whole absence-only riff. So, I don't know, if any of my, I'm saying all this as a man, and I understand that as a man, I don't understand this, the way that those of you who are women watching or listening to the show would understand it. And so you may, you know, if you want to share your thoughts on that, give us a shout. What are we going to do about the austerity, this Republican austerity? 2.2 million jobs missing right now because of the, because of Republican austerity. And more than that, frankly, because the Republicans have filibustered so many good pieces of legislation that would have put Americans back to work and that would have brought our factories back home. What are we going to do about that? It seems that the only solution is going to be in the election of 2014. And my concern is that the conservatives are already pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into that election. And it's a midterm election. A lot of people don't even show up. And Sherrod Brown's on the Banksters. Give his call, office a call and say, good on you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And or check out SherrodBrown.com. You can communicate with him there, too. And call your senators and tell them to support the Brown-Bitter bill. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And there's... Where there's a lot going on, but this, from our being robbed by the banksters, and Sherrod Brown actually doing something about it, good on him. To these women who were just released, and the story is just, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail about this story because as is, I think probably pretty much always the case, as time goes on, we learn more and more about it, and I don't want to wander into the territory of something that. You know, tomorrow I'm going to end up saying, oops, wrong on that. And this is really sensitive stuff. But just the more general concept, Elizabeth Smart is out there. She is now a young woman in her 20s, and she's made this her career, is speaking out. She runs a foundation to help educate kids about sexual crimes and adults as well. I mean, she was teaching at Johns Hopkins or speaking at Johns Hopkins. So it's important stuff. It's a really important stuff. Mark in Juarez, Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today, brother? I'm going to try to remain calm, but I just want to tell you about the banksters here in the United States.
Okay.
My mom got sick, deathly ill. She died. All right, so my mom owned her house outright in El Paso. So she said, I need some help. I need to see a doctor. She had Medicaid, but anyways, long story short, she wanted to see another doctor. So we took a $40,000 loan out on her house. She owned her house outright. We used a mortgage company along with the big bank company. They worked together.
Right.
So we took the $40,000 out. Literally, my mom died within that month where she got the money. I said, okay, well, we still got the money. I'll give you back the money. That $40,000 turned to almost $80,000 within 30 days, and I couldn't believe it.
You're kidding.
Basically, they just wanted the house. It was crazy. So I didn't take it lying down. I got a lawyer and got it all worked out, but that $40,000 ended up turning into $50,000. Now, I work for minimum wage in the United States. I just can't believe that they run roughshod. And in the, like you say it all the time, in the United States, medical bills will put you in bankruptcy like you won't.
Half of all bankruptcies in America are from medical bills. And in the rest of the developed world, the percentage is zero.
Yeah. Like I told my mom, I said, Mom, come back to Mexico.
Yeah.
She goes, no, I have faith. I go, okay. That's your decision.
Now you live in Juarez, Mexico. What's the healthcare system like there?
I love my healthcare system here. It's different than the United States. Let me give you an example. My wife, a last baby, I'm an American citizen, but I'm a Mexican citizen. I'm in both places.
Uh-huh.
My wife wanted to have a baby. We said, well, for immigration purposes, let's go across the border and we'll check out a hospital. They wanted $23,000. We ended up having the baby. If you look up Star Medica, is the hospital that we use here.
Uh-huh.
It's an awesome hospital. She stayed 7 days in the hospital and it cost me $1,000.
Yeah, amazing.
So,
amazing. I remember seeing a story some time back that Mexico was flirting with or had rolled out some sort of a national health care program that people could buy into for $100 or $200 a month. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, it's $234 a year. It's not by the month. And that system works good. My sister-in-law,
Whoa. She
just had a gallbladder out here in Juarez at the general hospital that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't cost her a dime, and it was... As a matter of fact, one of the doctors, he's Mexican, but he was in school in Arizona, did the operation because they did a deal with the university and the school, and they sent him to the United States to learn. But in return, he had to come back and to pay for a school that the Mexican government used there in the United States.
So in Mexico, there is a single-payer health care system, a government single-payer health care system, and it's $234 a year?
Yeah, that's what my sister-in-law pays. I think they're based on the income and what you do for job.
Uh-huh.
If you just work in a factory and stuff like that, I think it's nothing. But if you have somewhat of an income, they go that way. It's a real good system. It works because the hospitals are kind of like the non-profit hospitals that the United States should have.
Well, like we used to have before Reagan. I mean, you know, when Reagan started pushing this and state after state started making it legal for hospitals to go for profit and for health insurance companies to go for profit. I mean, I grew up in Michigan, and in Michigan, the hospitals and health insurance companies by law both had to be not for profit until the 80s. And then when they started flipping for profit, that's when Bill Frist's daddy stepped in and started buying up all these old county hospitals and just squeezing the blood out of them, basically. And that's how Bill Frist's daddy became worth $3 billion. And look at what's happened to the cost of health care since the mid-80s, since the Reagan era. But apparently that did not happen in Mexico. Apparently they've kept it not-for-profit down there. That's very interesting, Mark. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM Radio in Juarez, Mexico. I appreciate the call, and thanks for the heads up. Great talking with you. Helene in Boynton Beach, Florida. Hey, Helene, what's up?
I wanted to comment about these three wonderful women who were released in Cleveland today.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to judge and say, well, why didn't they run away? As a person who's abused, you protect your abuser.
Mm-hmm.
They psychologically work on your mind, and you will spend a lifetime protecting them. Even though the voice inside of you says, don't protect them, what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah. I understand. Helene, thank you for sharing that. This is basically what Elizabeth Smart was saying, although she was taking it a step further with this whole thing about abstinence-only education. Wayne in Granby, Massachusetts. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I guess my comment was about what you were saying about how the Republicans are standing in the way of any kind of job creation by Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, who had been a Republican all his life, although he didn't vote for these kind of Republicans, was actually a member of the CCC. I think you and I are about the same age. Can you imagine trying to get something like the CCC passed today?
Oh, yeah. This is the Civilian Conservation Corps, and FDR put this together to put people to work, to have the government be the employer of last resort. And what they did is they went out and they planted trees all across the Midwest to stop the Dust Bowl. And it did stop the Dust Bowl, by the way. And it put millions of people, or hundreds of thousands, I don't know the numbers, but it put a lot of people back to work and got us out of the Depression, in part, anyway.
Did you see the Ken Burns, the Dust Bowl special?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was about 6 months or a year ago.
Yeah, they just showed it here in the Springfield area again.
Mm-hmm.
And what got me was the people who, and these probably were diehard Republicans for the most part, and they're saying that the people who thought that trying to save the farmers from the Dust Bowl were the rich people.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying, don't bother with them. We don't need that. And they're saying, no, no, we just needed these jobs in order to feed our families so we wouldn't starve to death.
Right, right. Well, and the Dust Bowl, you know, the action on the Dust Bowl really started happening when the Dust Bowl started hitting the cities. You'll recall, you know, and Ken Burns shows that in his documentary where when it hit Chicago. And as I recall, hey, even New York, didn't it?
So what an incredible thing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it truly is. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Johnny in Snow, Oklahoma. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Man, I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
You know, you was talking about the banksters and the power that they yield nowadays. You know, we got to put our checks in the bank to cash them. Government checks. We got to put them in the bank to cash them.
Mm-hmm.
They're still drawing money today.
Yeah. Well, this is why, you know, Bernie Sanders has suggested that the post office ought to be able to do more things than just sell postage. I used to, when we lived in Germany, I used to cash checks at the local post office. It was the Bundespost, they called it. And, you know, I mean, the German post office could do a whole bunch of things. And I don't know if that's still the case. I mean, this was 30 years ago. But, it seems like, frankly, I think the best solution, Johnny, is for each state to charter their own bank, a state bank, like North Dakota has done, and then use the profits from that bank to cover the costs of running the state and for the benefit of the citizens of the state, and to use the bank to loan money to people in the state, you know, residents of the state, for things like mortgages and you know, the cost of starting new businesses and small businesses and things like that. And it's worked really, really well for North Dakota. If California were to stop using the giant banks for all the money that is flowing through the state of California, just through the state treasury for their pensions and for everything else, if they were to stop using the big banks and simply use a state bank, there would be a huge surplus in California. And they could, you know, there's so many things that they could do. I was going to say there'd be no deficit, but Jerry Brown's kind of taking care of that now. But it used to be that they would do away with the deficit. Now there's so much more that they could do. This movement to create state banks, I think, is a really important one, although the banksters are going to lobby against it like absolute crazy. So, Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Paradigms of progressives?
Paradigm, a language paradigm. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
The language paradigm, I think, that we're trying to talk in. I consider myself progressive. I'm a little bit conservative, and I'm a little bit liberal. It just depends on what we're talking about. But the paradigm that we're speaking in, for instance, Senator Brown, appreciate what he's doing. But when we're on the air speaking to each other, he's not really picking up on what's going on out here on the ground.
Oh, I think he absolutely has, Bob. You know, of all the people in the United States Senate, respectfully, and thank you for the call, Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown are at the top of the list, in my mind. They are the two guys who genuinely really do get it. And this is, you know, like I said, this is not a complete rollback of Glass-Steagall. I don't think that's probably politically possible right now, but this is something that he can get Republicans to go along with, which is a big deal. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. Ron wanted to ask if I'd go to Mexico to have my gallbladder taken out, but he just vanished. How interesting. Would you? 10 minutes before the hour, fair and only slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartman Program. Coming up in, by the way, in the next hour, Rob Pincus is going to be with us. He's the guy at the NRA who said that guns should be stored in kids' bedrooms. I'm looking forward to talking to this guy. And in our third hour, you know, I saw this story yesterday and I thought, The phrase is slut shaming, but basically what it is, you know, these schools going into these dress codes. Oh, young lady, young women, you cannot dress sexy, basically. And, you know, we've got a dress code here in this school. And it's really in some places going on steroids. And I was wondering out loud to Louise, is this how we get to the Taliban? Is this how we get to the burqa? And is this the beginning of that kind of a movement here in the United States? And so we're Annie Rose Strasser is going to drop by. She used to be a press assistant to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and she's now a deputy managing editor over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. I think it's fascinating. And so that's going to be, we're going to talk about that in our third hour. And of course, throughout all 3 hours, the rest of the news of the day. The CIA just, by the way, got rid of one of their guys linked to these illegal detentions. Billy in Scituate, Mass. Am I remembering the name of that town right, the pronunciation right, Billy?
Yes, Scituate.
Yeah, Scituate. Thank you. I've been through there. I think I had lunch there once, in fact. But anyhow, so you what's up?
Beautiful little town. I had called last week, but I just want a push again. In terms of no matter what issues you're working on, whether, you know, foreign, domestic, national health care, et cetera, I just think it's so important that all of us really get on, you know, the move to amend, bandwagon, whatever you want to refer to it. I know you always push it all the time, but no matter what, I just think that is the biggest issue that we can.
What astounds me is that, to the best of my knowledge, I don't listen to a lot of other progressive talk radio, frankly, because I just don't have the time. I mean, Louise and I both work 12 to 13 hour days every day doing this show and the TV show. And I do see a little bit of progressive TV at night. But I've not heard any, and I read a lot of progressive websites, and virtually nowhere am I seeing movetoamend.org or even the meme, other than when it occasionally gets promoted by Senator Sherrod Brown or Senator Bernie Sanders, or now you've got Senator Al Franken pushing, you know, variations on this. And I agree with you. I think it should be issue one. There's a lot of things we need to do in the meantime. And, for example, the, you know, restraining the banks that Senator Brown is working on along with Senator Vitter, which I never in my wildest dreams could have imagined Sherrod Brown and David Vitter, you know, sitting down and saying, let's agree on something, which means that it's really, these guys are, in my opinion, now I this is not based on any conversation that I had with Senator Brown, but my sense of it is, again, not from my conversation with him, but just my sense in general, is that the members of the House of Representatives and the Senate are starting to actually genuinely be afraid of these giant banks, of the danger that these giant banks represent to our economy. It's really starting to worry them. And my next book is about the big crash coming. I'm with you. We need to go to movetoamend.org and get on that. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Barnard, Kansas. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I was just watching RT, and they're having a news conference where Kerry and the Russian Secretary of State, I think, finally agreed on they're going to go back to the Geneva Agreement from last year, and the Obama administration has finally decided to go with that to stop the Syrian thing.
And so the Russians and the Americans are going to negotiate a ceasefire in Syria. Presumably the Russians talking to Bashar al-Assad and, if I remember his name right, the president of Syria, and the Americans talking to the various rebel factions that we've been funding. Good luck on that. Well, John, thanks for the heads up. I'll see what I can learn about that at the top of the hour, and I'll fill you in after the break. But thanks for that heads up. I appreciate that. Art in Goshen, New York. Hey, Art. Art, you are on the air. You wanted to talk about Richard Wolff's book, Democracy at Work? Art is not on the air. Okay. Well, that's fine. You know, if your phone's on mute, that doesn't work. And if you're listening, if you're watching your TV or listening to the radio, you know, I forgot to mention this at the top of the hour. Today is the last day to vote for Jacob Dean, our associate producer emeritus. Jacob produced our program for 4 or 5 years, for quite some time. And he's trying to get a Democracy for America scholarship to go to the Netroots Nation Convention. So please get over to TomHartmann.com and click the link there to vote for Jacob. Today is the last day for that vote. Ethan in New York City. Ethan, we got a minute to the end of the hour. It's yours. What's up?
I'll try to make this quick. It's, I heard you say something about you inviting somebody from the NRA over.
In the next hour, Bob Pincus.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be watching that. But, you know, can you ask him a question for me?
Well, sure, I'll try.
Yeah, they're so big on guns. Ask them, why is it in America that whenever somebody from a Muslim background, when they have a weapon of any sort, especially a gun, they're considered a terrorist? When a white person has a gun, it's always they're considered mentally unstable. But when a black person has a gun, they're considered a problem, a thug, or something like that. They always talk about whoever supports guns in America, whoever doesn't support guns. They never come to places, and they never come to the black neighborhood and wonder what, you know, how we feel about it. They always want to talk about us, but they never want to face us. You know, you want to talk about guns in America, bring that message to a black family like the ones in Chicago who are basically, you know, to the mothers out there who got killed, that are being killed by drive-by shootings and all that other
stuff. Okay. I will do that. I will do that. I just made a note to myself. Thank you, Ethan, for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back with the fellow who told the NRA, put guns in your kids' bedrooms. It should be entertaining, interesting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. 6 minutes past the hour. Last week at the NRA convention, or last weekend at the NRA convention, one of the speakers who got the most publicity, whether he wanted it or not, was Rob Pincus, who a firearms and personal defense expert, professional trainer, the owner of ICE Training, his website icetraining.us. When he suggested that guns should be stored in kids' bedrooms, in gun lockers in their bedrooms. And a lot of us went on the air afterwards and said, what? Really? So I thought I would just ask him in person. Rob Pincus, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Are you a parent?
I am.
I mean, I've raised three kids. I was one myself. I have three brothers. I can tell you, I remember when we were, my parents never owned a gun, but I remember when I was like maybe 6 or 7 years old and my parents were gone. We had a babysitter and we found a box of condoms in my dad's bedroom and it was well concealed. And we didn't know what they were. We thought they were really cool balloons. And when my parents came home, they discovered me and my three brothers out in the front yard with like 10 or 15 blown up condoms, these giant balloons, bouncing them around. In retrospect, can't imagine my father's humiliation. And the poor little babysitter, she had no idea what they were and what was going on. She was, you know, some 13, 14-year-old. Had that been a gun rather than a condom, I shudder to think what would have happened. Do you really think that guns should be stored in kids' bedrooms?
Well, I don't think that guns should be stored in the same way that one would store, prophylactic. I think that when you say lockers, in the presentation at the NRA show, what I was talking about was gun safes and actually securing them. So right. The logic is that, in context, the logic is, when someone chooses to have a firearm inside of their home for defense of their family in a worst-case scenario, they really have two options. Should they keep it where they spend most of their time, secured in a safe, the bedroom, the home office, in the event that if someone tries to break into their home or does break into their home, they'll be close to their tool of defense, or should they hide it in the place that they are going to secure themselves and their family, which we call their barricade area, while they lock a door, get on the phone with the police, and of course hope that the police will get there before they're forced to use the gun to defend themselves. So as a parent, you of course probably agree with me that one of the first things that would occur to you if you thought there was an intruder in the home is to go check on your kids. And knowing that, I think one of the options we have to consider is...
The first thing I would do if I thought an intruder was in the home is I'd dial 911.
Okay, well, I wouldn't. I would go check on my daughter. If I thought she were in the house, I wouldn't stop to make a phone call. I would be worried about protecting her.
I don't think it takes that long to make a phone call. And I want the police on the way. I want somebody who actually you know, knows how to deal with things like that on the way.
And I think that's the issue. A responsible firearms owner who has a home defense firearm is going to know how to handle the situation, and they're going to plan ahead. And that's really what the purpose of the seminar was to say, when you go check on your kids, one of the things we advise you have there is an old cell phone. You know, an old cell phone on a charger, even if it's not on contract, can be used to make a 911 call. So that's something else we advise being kept in the kids' room, so that you can barricade there, get the police on the way, and if you do have the training and the responsible ownership of a firearm, then you can also be standing there with a perfectly legitimate and efficient tool of defense should that intruder get in.
But when you look at the numbers, Rob Pincus, the probability of somebody stopping a home intruder with a gun, you look at compared to the probability of a kid accidentally killing another kid or somebody committing suicide with a gun, I mean, there are not that many home intrusions in America. There are not that many people who successfully, defend themselves with weapons. And even, I mean, what we had this district attorney, was it in Colorado? It was a couple of weeks ago. The guy, was prosecuting a bad guy who came into his house, killed his wife, and then killed him as he was heading for his gun. I mean, it's you having a gun in your house does not make you omnipotent and does not turn you into Superman. It just makes you a guy with a gun in his house who's more likely to either commit suicide with it or have your kid accidentally shoot somebody.
Well, I agreed with you up to that last point. I think the issue here is, in context, this whole security plan doesn't revolve around the gun. Too often the conversation with the people that don't understand guns, or people that aren't used to guns, people that aren't comfortable with guns, and as you said, didn't grow up with guns, the conversation is just about the gun. At the NRA convention, the gun is already established as a taken-for-granted premise.
Well, I'm comfortable with guns. I've used a lot of guns. I'm a fairly decent shot. And I not professionally competitively, but my brother and I shoot competitively regularly and have for years and years. And I would not have a gun in my home if I had children in my home. There's no way. I mean, you just look at the numbers. If my parents had a gun, I would have found it. There's no way I wouldn't have found it.
Would you educate your kids about guns today, whether you would have chose to own one or not? Would you educate them about operating them safely and knowing how to act around them?
Well, yes. And I have to say that because all of my kids, when they were kids, I had taken them to shooting ranges. I mean, they've all handled firearms. They're all familiar with firearms and firearm safety. But that's a whole different thing from having a gun safe in my son's room when he's 8 years old.
In the concept of a condom or the proper operation of a condom. So when you found that box of condoms, you embarrassed your parents. No one got hurt because it wasn't important to be educated about condoms. But we agree that a responsible parent would educate their children once they were old enough to operate a gun about guns.
But if I was 7 or 8 years old, no matter what, I mean, you've got to know this. A 7 or 8 year old, no matter how well you educate them about the gun, they're going to be thinking, oh boy, I want to get my hands on that.
Well,
especially
if
it's in my bedroom. I mean, boy, then I can work on it for hours and hours instead of just that, half a day when dad and mom went shopping or something.
The experience of millions of gun owners around the U.S. and millions of gun-owning families around the U.S. is contrary to that. That doesn't happen because the curiosity aspect is taken away.
Actually, it does happen.
It happens.
It happened 500 times last year that kids accidentally killed other kids.
Violent home invasions happened at a much more frequent rate.
Not that we're successfully repelled by people with guns.
That's where I was just going with that. You like to say that they weren't successfully repelled with gun owners, but that's why I educate people. That's why we advocate that people are trained and prepared to defend themselves with guns.
But see, if somebody's coming into your house, with malicious intent, it just seems to me like you are taking such a chance by doing anything other than just dialing 911 and getting the hell out as fast as you can. Because they're just as likely to take your gun from you and use it against you.
Well,
what's all this hysteria? I mean, home invasions are really quite rare in the United States. Isn't the NRA in the business of just pumping and selling fear?
Well, what about the fear that you're creating when you talk about the very rare occasion of a child finding an unsecured gun and killing another child? That's very.
But it happens more than once a day in America. That doesn't seem all that rare to me.
I think I would have heard of it if it did, but What I'm curious about is how we think that calling 911 instantly solves the problem.
I'm not saying it does.
At the seminar that has gotten so much attention at the NRA convention, I taught one on Friday, one on Saturday, and one on Sunday. The first step that we teach in a three-step plan is to evade. The first thing we teach is get out of the house. If you're standing by the back door and the bad guy's coming in the front door, get out. But again, as a parent, if the kids are upstairs, I'm not going to run out the back door. I'm going to run upstairs to where the kids are. I'm not going to abandon my family and hope the police get there in time.
But see, we should, I just think even having this conversation. One of my callers earlier asked me to ask you, why is it that when people with guns who are white they're identified as shooters, when they're Muslim or people of color, they're identified as terrorists?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
It doesn't seem very fair, does it?
All right. Rob Pincus, his website, icetraining.us, firearms and personal defense expert. Thanks for dropping by, Rob.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. Would you have a gun in your kid's house, in your kid's room?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I just keep remembering, being 7 years old, bouncing condoms in the front yard, and that look on my dad's face when he drove up. And I don't think it's a good idea. Welcome back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Would you have a gun in your kid's house? I don't know. Matt in Lycoming, Pennsylvania. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Tom.
You have a gun policy in your house?
Yes, I do, and I recently started it. Most of my family, almost all of them, are what I call locked and loaded. They carry all the time.
Really?
So I told them if they come over to visit, I don't care if they bring their gun, but they're not allowed to bring it into my house.
That's not unreasonable.
No, I don't think it is. I have four close family members that are refusing to come visit me because of this.
Really? Because they're afraid that if they're in your house, they're going to have to whip it out and start shooting at any moment. Or is this just a statement of, hey, you're insulting my Second Amendment rights?
I think it's that, but I also think it's a matter of control.
Yeah. Yeah, you wonder if the gun, it's like the NRA peddling fear all the time. To what extent are the people who are most vulnerable to a message of fear people who feel like their lives are out of control and they're seeking control? And one way to have that control is to have a gun or a sense of control anyway. I would say it's a false sense of control. But you think
it is. And I believe in the king of the castle theory. But by making the statement, by not agreeing with my policy, they're actually saying that they not only want to be kings of their castle, they want to be kings of my castle also.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I go along with that. You should certainly have the right to say, you can't bring a gun into my house. This is my house. Just like pretty much anything else. I mean, if somebody who has a real issue with alcohol and wants to say, please don't bring alcohol into my house. I mean, you should just respect that. This should be a matter of simple respect, not somebody who's a militant vegetarian. Please don't bring a burger into my house. But guns are actually, deadly. I mean, they can kill people. So, Matt, good on you. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Tom, in Brockton, Mass., listening on Sirius, you want to disagree with me?
Yeah, well, number one was the district attorney, okay?
Yeah.
Timeline is important. So if you're telling me that somebody that he knew someone was out to murder him,
yes,
and his wife, okay, dialing 911 in a short situation is not going to do anything because the police will be there in minutes. If somebody had it for him that they wanted to shoot him with a handgun,
right,
okay, dialing 911 is useless. Okay, he didn't.
But see, even having a handgun was useless in his case because this guy came in with an AR-15 assault rifle. This guy just,
he was not armed at that point when he was shot. Correct?
Right, that's correct. But I'm asserting that even if he was armed, he probably would have been taken out.
But not necessarily. Not necessarily. Okay, just because an AR-15 is a rifle doesn't necessarily mean that someone with a handgun couldn't have drawn the weapon first. So, I mean, your arm, with all due respect, your armchair quarterbacking on that one.
Oh, I absolutely am, and I'll cop to that. And I think that the guy was dumb to turn down the police protection. As long as there's somebody who has, you know, sworn to kill him running around loose, he should have a cop out in front of his household, you know, every day, all the time, or somebody watching his house. Although, that probably wouldn't have stopped this guy either, because, I mean, you know, this guy was like on a suicide mission. And that's
okay. Well,
you know,
there's nothing, that, and you know something. Then there's not a lot you can do in that situation. But as far as home break-ins, where someone breaks in the middle of the night, you're correct. Those are very rare. All right.
Right.
But I don't have a problem if a homeowner has a firearm on their person or wants to put that underneath their pillow at night. Okay, and then lock it when they leave work. I don't have an issue with that. I think people should be allowed to do that.
And people are allowed to do that. I'm not saying people shouldn't be allowed to do that. I'm not talking about gun control here at all. I'm asking, is it a good idea to have a gun in your home? Or, I mean, you know, this guy took it even, Rob Pincus took it even a whole step farther, saying put a gun in your child's bedroom. And it just seems to me like that's like off the scale wrong.
Children should not have firearms to themselves. If parents want to let their kids shoot, you have to have an adult around them. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I don't see anybody advocating allowing 5-year-olds to take a gun outside their house.
Actually, you have there's an entire industry devoted to this. Last week, a 5-year-old shot his 2-year-old sister with his brand new Cricket brand My First Rifle is the logo, the slogan, 22. It's a 22 that's marketed for parents to give to their kids. And this family thought, oh, how cool. Well, we'll give our 5-year-old son a 22 for his birthday. And they gave him a 22 for his birthday, and he shot his 2-year-old sister.
Yeah, well, the parents should have never allowed that kid to have that weapon.
Shouldn't it be more, Tom, that you and I should get together and say, just like we don't allow alcohol and tobacco companies to advertise to children, we will not allow firearms to be marketed to children?
No, because it's part of an American tradition. I grew up with guns, okay? I didn't go out and shoot my classmates. I used to shoot in a rifle range at the Robinson Hill Elementary School. Okay, they had a rifle range.
So you think it's fine for weapons manufacturers to be marketing their products specifically to children?
Absolutely.
To be creating demand on the part of children, to be using the billion. Go ahead.
Thank you. Parents have to be responsible for their children. That's a no-brainer, okay?
That's a huge I disagree. It would be nice if parents could be responsible for their children, but the fact of the matter is that A, every child is different. B, every child, parent-child relationship is different. C, you've got a lot of parents who are, you know, half of all children in America come home to an empty house. You know, how are you going to be responsible for your kids when both parents have to work because, you know, 32 years of Reaganomics has essentially raped our economy, have ruined our economy. And so there's nobody home. I mean, it's a cliche, Tom, to say parents have to be responsible for their children.
Yeah, by the way, Bill Clinton didn't help out the country with repeal of Glass-Steagall, did he?
No, Bill Clinton did not help out the country with the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I agree with you on that. Thank you for the call. I guess we finally agreed on something. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Truth be told, though, the repeal of Glass-Steagall idea, that was Phil Graham's idea. He was a Republican. His wife was on the board of Enron. You know how that all worked. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And are we just stoking fear in America? I mean, is that what the NRA is? Is this all about let's sell more guns? I think so. Paul in Renton, Washington. Hey, Paul, you had you were in a well-regulated militia?
Yeah, I'm a Vietnam vet, and in order for me to get in the Army, I had to have an extensive background check, a full felony background check. Mm-hmm. I had to take an aptitude test. I had to have a physical. And when I was issued the weapon and basic training, it had no clip. It was empty.
Right.
All it was a 10-pound piece of wood with a steel rod in it. And when we went to the rifle range, we were issued by a personal trainer 3 rounds at a time. and we had to insert the round hand manually. And then after we fired, we were instructed on how to hold the weapon and what we did wrong. Then we get another round.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that for three rounds at a time. Then we inspect our targets, and then they give us another three rounds. In every position, we had a personal trainer. All 55 of us did.
Mm-hmm.
And we never shot with the clip until the seventh week when we took our actual proficiency in shooting. And during that time, we were physically tested with extensive physical training. We were also bullied with the sergeants are always on your back.
Sure.
They called you all kinds of names, questioned your parenthood, questioned your sexuality, questioned your manhood, questioned everything. They tried to pop your button every time.
Right.
And we had one guy that broke, and he was gone.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. That was the background check.
So are you suggesting, Paul, that before people buy weapons in the United States, they should at the very least, like before you can drive a car, you have to get a driver's license. And before you get the driver's license, at least the very first time you get it, you have to demonstrate your proficiency, your competency as a driver, that we should at the very least have people be required to have to demonstrate their proficiency with a weapon before they buy it?
Yeah, sure. And like I said, we were bullied for 24/7.
Yeah, no, we've all seen the movies. I don't think that we need to go that far, but I'm with you on that. And Paul, thank you for the call. I mean, my suggestion, and this is like way beyond anything that any politician would ever go near. And the politicians, they couldn't even get through, let's close the gun show loophole on background checks, right? I mean, they couldn't even get, although Jeff Flake is like trying to figure out can we get this revoted? And Harry Reid is going, hey, you want another vote on this? Not until we talk about immigration. And the Republicans are all pulling their hair out because they realize what a huge, horrible political mistake they made by just, going down the NRA road. But in any case, my position on this, forget the background checks. I mean, that's small stuff. Guns should be treated the same way cars are. Yes, we have a right to drive on our roads. In fact, our roads are in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to authorize to raise taxes and spend money for postal roads and post offices. It's right there in the Constitution. Now, we can get into a whole conversation about the post office. That's another, we've had that many times. But you got a right to ride on a road. And before cars, you didn't need a license to drive a horse. Because people, by and large, it's pretty obvious if you knew how to ride a horse. And if you didn't know how to ride a horse, you were not on that horse very long. Whereas with cars, everybody thought they knew how to use them. And once they started going fast enough that hitting, a 20, 30 mile an hour collision head on, you kill somebody. Or hitting somebody in the street. I mean, those cars, those early cars, there were over 100 auto manufacturers by 1915. I mean, it was a big deal. It was a whole brand new industry. It was exploding, and there were no rules. And so they said, people are dying. These cars are capable of killing people. So three simple things. Number one, registration. The car has a vehicle identification number. It's put on it when it's manufactured, and it is taken off the books when that thing is destroyed. So you have a continuous chain of custody. You always know who owns that car. Number two, proficiency. Prove that you know how to use it. Take a driver's test and get a driver's license. And number three, insurance. You have to have liability insurance. I think it's insane that had those 20 children in Connecticut, in Newtown, Connecticut, had those 20 children been hit by a crazed drunk driver or even a homicidal driver, mowed down as they were walking out of a school bus, every one of their families would be negotiating with Geico right now for the $1 million liability policy because the drivers would be required to have it. But because they were killed by a gun owner or by a gun, they got nothing. Not even burial expenses, not even the cost of the kind of counseling and therapy that they're going to need. They got nothing. That seems to me bizarre. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Happy birthday.
Oh, no,
you.
No, no.
Happy birthday.
I thought we'd get through the day without that. Thank you, John.
Happy
enough. No,
birthday.
No, you actually, you have to stop singing that because the company that owns the copyright to that song will send us nasty letters and threaten to sue us.
Well, you share the same birthday as my dad, so I thought I'd.
Oh, well, thank you.
I know it's yours.
Thank you.
So,
that's,
and you
that's,
mentioned it.
I'm honored.
Thanks for everything.
Sure.
Thank you for everything you do.
So, but that's not what you wanted to call about. You had a story about.
Actually, that is what I wanted to call about. But your call screener said if she put that in there, then you wouldn't answer it.
Oh, are you serious? Okay, all right. So I should move on to the next caller then. All right.
Yes, you can.
John, okay. Thank you very much for the call. That was sweet. Dan, my call screener, Danielle is yelling. I didn't. You punked her. Okay, Dan in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Legitimate call.
Okay, thank you.
My personal story is I actually used a firearm to defend myself from an intruder.
Uh-huh. When was this?
Atlanta police 20 minutes to respond to robbery in progress, even though I lived about 600 yards from a station.
Yeah.
So my options were defend myself or wait, 20 minutes for God knows what to happen.
Right. Now, you were I lived for almost 15 years in Atlanta. Where were you living?
Inman Park.
Oh, okay. So, that and was this more than a decade ago when that was kind of a dangerous and sketchy neighborhood? It's kind of gentrified now.
2006, very yuppie.
Yeah, okay. So it was...
Starbucks was two doors down.
Yeah. Huh, interesting.
So,
here's another question. Because you look at the statistics, read the stories, it seems that most of the time when people break into somebody's house, it's not because they have any intent to harm anybody. It's because they want to steal something. And in most cases, if they figure out that somebody's home, the person who does the break-in is the one who flees. And the percentage of people who are coming into someone's home to actually do bodily injury to the person in that house is minuscule, and it's pretty much limited to men coming in to rape women. And even that is very, relatively speaking, very rare in the United States. So what makes you think that having a gun kept you any safer than just being really, really quiet and letting them steal something?
Because he was coming up the stairs to where I was stuck on the second level of my townhouse.
Yeah.
He would have found me.
And how did you... And okay, so what happened? What happened? Did you say I've got a gun and he turned around and ran away?
No, I heard him coming up the stairs. I chambered a shell into my pump action shotgun. I heard him bring him back down the stairs and he fled the building.
Yeah, okay. So he heard you heard you chamber the shell. My assertion is, Dan, that first of all, I've got this really cool little app on my phone that plays mostly fart noises, but I should probably put on there the sound of, a 10-gauge shotgun being, with a shell being chambered.
Well, if your phone is capable of firing that shell, then you're in good shape because you don't know if he's armed or not.
No, but I think you're making my point that the majority of intruders have no desire to confront a homeowner, armed or unarmed.
Well, here's the thing is... And you can't keep mentioning the statistics. Statistics show, this is according to the Clinton Justice Department, well over a million crimes are thwarted every year by legal gun owners. You compare that to the number of accidental shootings every year.
Thwarted?
Not even a comparison.
I don't believe it, Dan.
Yeah.
I don't believe it.
Look it up. You don't have to believe me. You can look it up yourself.
Yeah.
It's part of the official records of the Clinton Justice Department.
Yeah. Drop into our chat room and give us that statistic. Give us a link to that or go over to TomHartman.com.
Sure. I'm happy to do it.
I would love to see that.
If you compare the number of crimes prevented every year by legal gun owners versus the number of accidental shootings or even murders, it's not even close.
Yeah. So why is it that in countries that have so many fewer guns, their crime rates are lower than ours?
It's not true. Look at Australia as an example.
Well, Australia has some of the most draconian gun laws in the world right now. They had a giant gun buyback program that was very successful after they had this mass shooting about 5 years ago. And they put into place some very, very strong gun laws. And guess what? Gun violence dropped. Crime dropped.
Crimes went up dramatically. Assault, rape, all went up by magnitude, 54%. Gun shootings went down just slightly. All other crimes went up dramatically.
We're apparently living in different worlds because my statistics disagree with yours. Dan, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I guarantee you, if crime went up 50% in Australia after people sold their gun, or, you know, so did the gun buyback program, there would be guns in Australia right now. There aren't. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com. Brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of the war in South Sudan. That's GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Ellen.
And by the way, those crystal hearts, if you order them today, we can get them to you by Mother's Day.
Okay, cool. And this let's just make this very clear. This is a small charity that you're running, and these are actual women in Sudan, and you actually go there and see them. And
I bring the crystals over, and I bring back the completed hearts.
Yeah, that is so cool. I have so much respect for you for doing this.
Thank you so much. We need to get you over there again.
Okay.
But speaking of again, the president did another news briefing today, this time with the president Park from Korea, South Korea. What was fascinating, and this is what, I mean, you know, you can watch all this on television, but you kind of got to be there to get some of the local color. And what happened is that there were about 75 press traveling with the president from Korea, and that was a huge amount. I've really only seen that either with China or when Yeltsin came from Russia many moons ago.
Mm-hmm.
But out of all of these, I only counted, and other people as well did the same thing, 5 women out of 75 people. And most of the president's aides, even though she's a woman, were men too, except for one handler that was wearing a bright yellow jacket, and she was sort of moving everybody together. Everybody else were men. It was quite astounding.
Yeah, this being the first female president of South Korea, the optics of that are a little amazing, actually, for a president who's a minority who you would think would be sensitive to such things.
Absolutely, but I guess it didn't happen. Anyway,
yeah.
The president talked about the 60th birthday of an agreement with the United States, and I guess 60th birthdays are a very big deal in South Korea, very special. And they talked about exchange programs. Both presidents talked about climate change, nuclear agreements, trade in North Korea. The president said it was the first foreign visit of President Park and that she was the first female president of South Korea. Now, he sort of pronounced it Pak, so I don't know, but it's written Park. Anyway, much on North Korea, the operative words were international community, and we should check, I want to actually wind up checking the transcript, how many times the words international community, provocative behavior were used. I'm going to do a word search later on. She talked about the deterrence from North Korea and a world without nuclear weapons should start in the Korean Peninsula. She also talked about working with China and Russia and on North Korea and working with them closely. President was also asked about Kim Jong-un. He quoted the American expression about paying attention not to what was said but what was done.
Hmm.
And then she was asked, the president of South Korea was asked, she asked sort of a rhetorical question. She said, who would invest in North Korea, a place that has such a flagrant disregard for agreements?
Hmm.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So although it didn't get much play, the president, as she said, there was a need for high-level U.S. work visas. She kind of said it. Nobody followed up on it. It sort of came
and went.
You mean
send South Korean engineers to the United States,
that
kind of thing?
That's right.
Oh, my. Ellen, a question, if I may. Just a caller called in and said that had heard, although I've been looking and I have not seen this, that Secretary of State Kerry has announced some sort of a deal with the Russians with regard to Syria, or is that Is that just a somebody misunderstanding something?
I have not heard anything about it today.
Okay, all right.
So
great. Maybe
it happened, but it's not on my radar screen.
Excuse my interruption.
Okay, then our president was asked about Syria. He said we had a moral obligation to end the slaughter and have a stable Syria and not one that would be threatening to its neighbors. He talked about the cost of doing nothing, and then he said, President Obama said, we are not doing nothing. He said there was understandably a desire for easier answers. He said, my bottom line is what's in the interest of American security. He then went on to say that there was a perceived crossing the red line. But he said you can't organize international cooperation on the basis of perceived. Now, this is what the killer is, and I'm wondering whether the press is going to pick up on it. He said we've tried that in the past, and it didn't work. And that was a clear dig on the Iraq situation and President Bush, which I found extremely interesting.
Yeah.
And again, people...
Well, was it a dig or was it a simple statement of fact, historical fact?
It is a statement of fact, but it was, you know, okay, you guys who want me to go to war here,
right.
Look what happened last time.
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's how I sort of read it.
Yeah. I mean, Bush should have been thinking Vietnam, but if he...
Well, right, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Okay, I shouldn't even be laughing about it because we've lost a lot of people.
You're right.
The president was also asked about sexual assaults in the military. As you know, the report has come out. He said that sexual assault is an outrage and a crime to whoever carries it out is betraying the uniform that they are wearing. He said he spoke to Secretary Hagel today, and they told him we have to step up our game and go after this exponentially.
Hmm.
He also said that there will be accountability, and this is not who we are, not what we are about. He said the bottom line is that I have no tolerance for this. He also expects, he said, consequences, and he listed court-martial, fired, discharges.
Yeah.
So
it's ironic the head of the Air Force sexual assault thing was just busted for sexual assault. I mean,
and
just,
drunk.
Yeah.
And groping people in a parking lot.
Yeah.
I just
not the
by
best
the way,
optics.
You know, fortunately I wasn't there to be groped, but I was in Watertown, Massachusetts, the night, of course, that they got the two alleged bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And last night, where was I when they found these three women? In Cleveland, Ohio.
Wow. What's the latest on that story out of Cleveland?
Well, the latest is that they're, you know, obviously talking to the three girls. I think the most interesting twist on that is that the son of the guy whose house it is had been given a writing assignment and had written about this and not know anything about it. It seems staggering. Did he never go in his father's house?
Wow. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and a couple of different stories coming together, maybe not. We'll do a reality check on this. These three young women who were released yesterday in Cleveland, apparently having been kidnapped for 10 years. Elizabeth Smart coming out yesterday and saying that one of the reasons that she didn't cry out for help when she was walking down the street with a man who had kidnapped and raped her was because she had been taught in an abstinence-only sex education class that women are like chewing gum, and that that no man would want her after she had been chewed, she had been used, that nobody likes chewing gum. And then in the midst of this whole dress code thing and this phenomenon of slut shaming. When I saw this story yesterday, I was talking with Louise, my wife, who also are one of our producers and the producer of our program, and I mean the Big Cheese producer, and I mean we've raised a couple of three kids, two girls, and we're talking about are we looking at the new American Taliban here? I mean, is this like patriarchy on parade? Is this misogyny starting to creep around the edges of our culture, or is this just, you know, schools trying to have some sort of reasonable order? And I think that our I wanted to get Annie Rose Strasser's opinion on this. Annie Rose is the deputy managing editor of Think Progress, which is where I first saw this story. It's titled "How Slut Shaming Has Been Written into School Dress Codes Across the Country," and the former press assistant to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Annie Rose, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, you know, I just threw out a whole bunch of stuff. Do you want to pull on any of those strings or whatever, or shall I start with a very specific question?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think that you hit a bunch of notes that I think make a lot of sense together. Obviously, there's a very big difference between a woman being kidnapped in Cleveland and a school telling a girl what not to wear. But I do think that there is an interesting connection here, in terms of just women's bodies, their ownership over their own bodies, people telling them what not to do and what to do with their bodies and sort of putting the onus on a woman to make the choices that will make her most safe. I think that's what a lot of this comes down to. And specifically when you look at, dress codes, you're talking about sort of how women are told that what they wear and how they present themselves sort of sexualizes them or desexualizes them and therefore makes them a target or not.
Yeah, and isn't that the central message of the Taliban? I mean, I don't mean this to be hyperbolic. I have actually talked with, I think it was maybe it was Jeremy Scahill and I. It was somebody who had been a reporter in the Middle East for a number of years and spent a lot of time over there, who knew a bunch of Taliban guys and who said, you know, the whole thing is, you know, the whole rationale is if women show any parts of their body, then men will, you know, run out of control and end up, you know, raping them or whatever. And therefore the women have to completely cover themselves up. And if the end result of that logic is the burqa, are we going down that road?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily feel comfortable comparing school principals to the Taliban, but I will.
Well,
say
I will.
But I will say that I think, you know, it stems from the same thing, which is that we have a society, a patriarchal society, which has told women that they are basically property of men or there for men's pleasure, and therefore that they should be told what to do based on how men will react. You know, you can see it in cases like the Steubenville case. A young girl was raped. Two men have been convicted of raping her. And she was told she was drunk, or she was told that she didn't act correctly, or she was told that she was implying, if not saying, that she wanted to have sex with them, based on her outfit or based on the fact that she had been drinking. And a lot of times that's what we see, is that women are told men will do these things and it's your responsibility to react. As opposed to when you talk about men and the crimes they commit, they're told you have agency over yourself. You make these decisions and you have to be responsible for your actions, or they're told you can sit there and do what you will and make sure there are no distractions in your life. And when we look at the way that women are treated, they're basically told to always be on the defensive, whereas men are told to always be on the offensive. It plays out in the workplace in the way that women are supposed to be in the workplace. It plays out in the football field, I think, is one of the places where we see it. And certainly it plays out in dress codes. We don't have dress codes for men like we have for women. And a lot of that is because women are told to wear certain things that make them look appealing to men, and men aren't really told the same to make themselves appealing to women.
There's been, you know, a lot of everybody learns about Martin Luther King. Everybody learns about the civil rights movement. And yet women were considered the property of their husbands up until the turn of the last century. I mean, there were laws on the books in states as late as 1900 that said that if a woman's husband died, that a male executor would be appointed. He would get one third of her estate. He would decide what religion or by whom her children were raised. And, you know, and the only courts that she could do anything in were courts that were specifically set up for retarded people or for children. And, you know, in other words, she had to have a male representative at court. In a very real way, aren't women the last of the group of the various minority groups, and which is kind of weird to say because women are a majority in society, to be liberated? And I use that word advisedly, realizing that even, you know, now the situation.
Yeah, I think one of the areas where we can look at how women are still very much considered property is abortion access. Men sitting in state houses across the country and on Capitol Hill in the United States nation, you know, the capital here,
right.
Are making decisions about what women can do. They're telling women that they can have an abortion at a certain date or they can't at another, that when there's a fetal heartbeat, suddenly it becomes irresponsible for a woman to make the choice about what's right for her. And it has nothing to do with the woman's life. And there's very, very little female right. input. 17 women in the Senate is somehow groundbreaking. It's not as though we have actual parity.
And the morning that after said, bill, I think, you know, too. Pardon me interrupting. But
right,
we have limited time. I forgive my interruption, but can you talk about slut shaming?
Sure. So it's a term that I think is pretty new and is just sort of broken into the mainstream, but is a really valuable one. Because what we do is when we talk about how women dress, we talk about them being sluts, as though by wearing a certain thing, they're inviting sexual interaction. The right. two things are actually not linked. We don't even have the same word for men. There's no word equivalent of slut for what a man can do or say or wear. But when we talk about women, we talk about how they will behave and how that behavior, you know, basically is the same as inviting a sexual interaction. Mm-hmm. So we don't talk about consent. A woman can't really consent in the same way to a sexual interaction because we assume that she's consented by wearing a low-cut, you know, blouse.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that then translates into social interactions where you have someone saying, that girl shouldn't be trusted because she's wearing a low-cut right. shirt.
So in the minute we have left, what do we do about this? Where do we go with this?
I think we just need to give agency back to women. We need to say that you can make your own choices about what you wear and what you do with your body and how you behave. And those things are not a man's to control or dictate or, comment on even. It's not the place of a principal to say your outfit looks too slutty. I would prefer if my school principal never said something like that to me because I would hope that he's not thinking about me like that.
Yeah, there you go. Which is another indication of this whole role thing. Brilliant. Annie Rose Strasser, Deputy Managing Editor of Think Progress and thinkprogress.org, of course, the website. This brilliant piece, How Slut Shaming Has Been Written into School Dress Codes Across the Country. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Great having you on. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating. So where do we go from here? And to what extent is there, there are physical differences. Welcome back. Talk Media for the Rest of Us, the Tom Hartman Program. I really think Annie Rose Strasser identified a really important point, and one that for many people, particularly many men, may be a wake-up, and that is that there is no male equivalent to the word slut. Or at least if there is, it's obscure. It's rarely used. And, for example, I remember back in 98 or 99, one day, Louise and I were living in Vermont, one day a fax came through a fax machine that was this three-page fax that was a formal invitation to come to Rome and have a personal audience with Pope John Paul II. And at first I thought it was a practical joke, and then I responded and discovered that, no, I was actually being invited to Rome for a personal audience with Pope John Paul II. And so, of course, I said, sure, I'm on my way. Can I bring my wife, and can she meet the Pope too? And they sent back a fax. Most of this communication was by fax back then. And they sent back a fax saying, she can come, she can be in the room. He probably will not speak to her or touch her or allow her to touch him. And then she has to dress a certain way. And they attached this long, in my memory, it's like 5-6 pages. It might have actually just been 2 or 3. But this long list of the things that Louise was allowed to wear or not wear in the presence of the Pope. And there wasn't a single word about what I was to wear. Now, maybe that's because in our society, you know, to put the very best possible interpretation on that, it's because in our society, men basically wear suits and ties, and we all dress the same for formal occasions. I mean, you know, what am I going to do, show up in a Hawaiian shirt and flip-flops? I mean, there's not even an, you know, it's not even conceivable. Whereas for women, there's a wide variety of things that are considered formal wear. I mean, just watch the Academy Awards. Every single man there is wearing black and white. You know, they all look like penguins. And yet, and the women are all dressed differently. So it could be that the Vatican felt that it was necessary to say, okay, out of the hundreds of varieties of things that you can wear, here's a, but the essence of it was that she had to cover her shoulders. She had to cover her arms. She had to cover her legs, to a certain length. And, you know, for it to be proper. So, in other words, to not look like a slut. There's no male equivalent word for this. I find the entire thing fascinating. Joe, you are a retired teacher who had a dress code for both genders in your school.
Yes, we do.
But was that dress code? I remember dress codes when I was a kid. It was like boys can't wear shorts, girls can't, you know, have to wear dresses or something like that. But that, I mean, that was a long time ago. But it wasn't, for girls, it might have been do not sexualize yourself. It wasn't for boys. For boys, it was don't be too casual.
Well, yeah, it's vastly different. I'm about your age, and it's vastly different than when we were in high school. But it was the fashion with the boys to sag their pants with the vernacular.
Yeah.
And where, you know, they would
hang them so low the top of their butt is showing.
They'd be exposing a lot of cleavage in the back.
Right.
But, you know, I wear shirt and tie every day. And that's my work environment. And I made an effort to make sure that that was a professional environment.
Uh huh.
And a really extremely low cut top on a girl who is a woman is just inappropriate. And it's a huge distraction. You know, I'm no prude, and mm-hmm. I really want to do my job, and I don't want to be looking over there going, what the, you know.
Would you suggest that the sagging pants that are showing some guy's butt crack or the top of his butt, that that is somehow sexual? It doesn't seem to me like that's sexual. It doesn't seem to me like that's an attempt to be sexually attractive. It seems to me that that's more of an attempt to assert, you know, membership in a particular community of people. You know,
I can tell you if they were trying to be sexual, it didn't work with most of the girls because
I
had asked the girls before, what did they think of that, and they hated it.
Right. So we're back to this thing of there's no equivalent to slut for men. Do I have that right?
Yeah. That is unfortunately the case.
And so dress codes around boys are not about being sexual. They're about being proper. Whereas dress codes for girls are around being sexual because they will distract boys. And you've got women like Annie Rose, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but you've got women suggesting, and I agree with her on this, that really shouldn't be something that the women have to worry about? Or is it just that, hey, that's biology, get used to it? I mean, where's reality here?
Well, I think it's still about being appropriate for that environment. And I think the boys should dress appropriately and the girls should dress appropriately. I don't think the sagging pants are appropriate, and I don't think a low-cut top is appropriate for a female.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Okay, Joe, thank you very much for the call. Barbara, how much time do we have? Oh, we only have 24 seconds. Barbara, you want to hold on and I'll pick you up after the break?
Yeah.
Okay.
Manhole
is the word, is the male equivalent?
Manhole.
Oh, interesting. And women use that word?
You know, I use it all the time when I tell my husband his pants are too tight.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay. So, but it's not as widely known. It's a more obscure word. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that. I just learned a word. And, yeah, you'd think I'd be old enough to have figured this out. 27 minutes past the hour. Should there be a gun in your kid's bedroom? And should that kid be wearing a strapless dress? We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And meanwhile, let's try to stop the banksters. Huh? Help Sherrod Brown out with this thing. Go to SherrodBrown.com and give him some props. The bad and the very, very pentapopemptically ugly. The good. The Raging Grannies. On Monday, the political singing group held a rally in front of the North Carolina State House to protest that state's sharp turn to the right in recent months. Joining together with a local chapter of the NAACP, the Grannies sung hymns critical of Republican policies and dared police to arrest them.
Dragging us back. Dragging us back to the bad old days when the poor had no voice. Now we're making a choice to stand up and sing out today. Arrest us and throw us in prison if that's what it takes to be heard. But you can't keep us quiet forever. The people will have the last word.
Well, the police did eventually arrest the Grannies, but member Jane Hare said it was all worth it.
We're older women who have strong opinions about the things that are just in this world. What good is an opinion without action?
Well said. Keep up the good work, ladies. The bad, Eric Rush. In his most recent column for WorldNet Daily, the conservative pundit accused the Obama administration of allowing terrorist attacks to justify an expansion of martial law. He wrote, in order to complete the power transfer to the degree that socialist power players desire, it will become an imperative for Obama to declare martial law at some point. This is in part why efforts to dismantle the Second Amendment have been so aggressive since Obama's reelection. In any case, there are a number of contingencies in play that may serve the administration in this regard. A coordinated upswell in jihadi activity throughout the United States, just enough to terrify but not too much to suppress, would be the perfect pretext under which martial law might be declared. Right. Insightful analysis, Eric. You know, we do have a tinfoil hat somewhere here in the studio. Just give us a call whenever you want to wear it. And the very, very ugly Governor Rick Perry. During a Sunday appearance on Family Research Council President Tony Perkins' Stand with Scouts webcast, Texas Governor Goodhair Rick Perry compared support for the Boy Scouts' ban on gay members to Sam Houston's opposition to slavery. Seriously, take a look.
And from this library that I speak, he made a powerful decision that cost him his governorship. He was against slavery, and he stood up and very passionately said, you know, Texas does not need to leave the Union over this issue of slavery. That's the type of principled leadership. That's the type of courage that I hope people across this country on this issue of Scouts and keeping the Boy Scouts the organization that it is today.
What a terrible analogy, Governor, and very, very remarkable. Johnny in Vacaville, California. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up, Johnny?
Well, let me tell you, I just really enjoy your show, Tom. And I
Thank
enjoyed
you.
Your interview with Anna Rose
Strasser.
Anna Rose Strasser?
Mm-hmm.
Was her name?
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the discussion on the slut discussion. But I was also interested in the discussion about the women's chattel status. Early in the century, and how much of it still holds sway in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I noted that, in fact, in some states today, still men cannot be prosecuted for raping their wives.
Right, marital rape. Yeah.
Yes, and so that's because of they assume that woman, once she gave her consent, she cannot withdraw it while she's still in the relationship.
Right.
And
yeah.
So that's all this assumed consent again, because I think the Taliban, I think the religious people want to cover the women because they don't trust the men to control themselves.
I think it goes beyond that. I think that it's male fear of women. I think that misogyny, you know, a hatred of women right. is rooted in a fear of women, and that fear of women comes from some deep and strange place. And I don't pretend to be enough of an expert on it. And being a man, I'm sure I'm walking around with some of it. But it's just, you know, just like being a white person, well, a person of any color, I suppose. There's racism in all of us. There's probably misogyny in all men. But yeah, good point. The marital rape.
Well, the other point I wanted to make, yeah. if I could, sure. is on the question of women being called sluts. What do men get called? And you heard the term man whore. Mm. My daughter, who's 28, has taught me this term man slut for a long time.
Oh, really?
And she uses the term man slut about people. So the younger people do have some ways of dealing with this
uh-huh.
that maybe we older ones haven't heard yet.
So. Okay. All right.
I wanted to share that one with you, too.
Thank you, Johnny. And thank you very much for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Jesse in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Jesse. What's up?
Thanks, Tom, for your show. It's one of my favorites. I actually want to also talk about the issue. I used to be a Buddhist monk,
mm-hmm.
and your story about the Pope reminded me of that. And in general, I think sexism is basically a form of people just trying to disempower other people and combined with some denial of one's own responsibility for lack of inner strength, perhaps. But with monks, at least in the tradition I was at, there was rules against touching or even being around or talking alone with women.
Hmm.
But it was the same for women monks,
right.
Nuns.
Right.
So, and that was all based on not judging the other person, but essentially because, you know, when you're trying to be celibate, those are the, when you, you don't know the strength of a river until you put up a dam, I guess is one thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, in other words, part of this might be well-intentioned schools trying to impose celibacy on their teenage kids?
Well,
or
yeah,
promote
right.
celibacy anyway?
I think that's a really good way to put it. So, right, there is, you know, so the Buddhist teaching was about non-attachment,
right.
and that's fine. It's totally voluntary, though. So then I think there's, you know, he also talks about the middle path. So all of us have a certain amount of non-attachment that we have to do if we're in a committed relationship or we're employing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's distortion of that by sometimes it's, you know, economic forces that are distorting it and sometimes just poor judgment and
right.
lack of wisdom.
Okay. Jesse, thank you for the call. I'm looking at the board here. We've got 10 lines lit up, and everyone is a man except for Cora. And I think Cora wanted to talk about guns in Taos, New Mexico. Cora, listening on KVOT.
Well, I was just going to mention briefly a different look at a different culture, a different time, a very good book, The Secret History of the Mongol Queens, How the Daughters of Genghis Khan Rescued His Empire by Jack Weatherford.
Really?
It's a very, very interesting book.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
But guns, I was just going to say, you know, fast food restaurants are being discouraged about handing out toys, you know, and the kiddie meals.
Right.
And so, you know, the gun manufacturer that manufactures pink and blue guns is just fueling the addictive junkie subculture of guns.
Yeah, I do not disagree. And I think that just like, you know, candy cigarettes is a bad idea, I think. And really, these are guns that actually shoot bullets and kill people, whereas candy cigarettes just rot your teeth. They don't kill your body. But marketing cigarettes to kids with cartoons and things, it's a bad thing, too. Cora, thank you for the call. Ryan in Wakanda, Illinois, you wanted to disagree. I'm not sure what you're disagreeing with.
Well, Tom, I kind of talked the whole last segment about how you were saying about women's clothing, they have dress codes, considered right. too provocative. I was just wondering if you could describe for me what would be considered too provocative for a man to wear as the conservative on the opposing side of that. You know,
well, I wonder if a man were to wear a pair of pants that was in the front down to the point where it was showing pubic hair, if that would be considered sexual. Or maybe it's possible that it's just, you know, other than to gay men who may find a man attractive, but that there's no way a man can make himself sexually attractive to a what? No, that can't be. That doesn't make any sense. So how do men dress in a way that is sexually provocative?
Right. That would be considered appropriate to create a dress code for.
Yeah. So.
I mean, that's kind of the thing. I mean, I think the reason why they have that dress code for the women is because there seems to be an issue with that.
Well, this was actually, you know, this was the thing about the Ed Sullivan Show when Elvis came on and CBS required them to shoot him only above the waist. It was because his pants were too tight and he was swiveling his hips. So, I guess that they thought he was a male slut. Brian, interesting point. Eric in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Pretty good. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm here. A few things. One, for the male slut, they also call them dogs, Lotharios, and players.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the sagging issue, that's actually from prison. That was men that were down to have anal sex with other men. So the sagging is sexual.
Mm.
And then a couple other things, too. I know when I went to the Vatican, I had shorts on. I actually had to borrow a friend's sweatshirt and put it on. It was like pants that I had, but that was back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then I was a teacher for a long time, and I got to see plenty, like, girls' panties that I didn't need to see as far as their shorts. And their stocks are just, you know, the mini skirts are really short.
Yeah. Okay. Eric, thank you. That's an interesting collection of points to discuss. We'll be back with more. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So rather than talking about slut shaming, maybe we should be talking about this whole chattel issue. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, nobody has called to address the question that really was the question in my mind, which was, are we moving in a Taliban direction? Not just the dress codes like trying to make schools appropriate, but is there a movement in the United States to just basically oppress women? Debbie in Lake in the Hills, Illinois, listening on WCPT.
Right.
Hey, Debbie.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
I'm just curious about, you know, men dressing provocatively. Haven't you ever seen like a fireman's calendar?
Oh yeah, Scott Brown did.
Calendar, or I think of Patrick Swayze on SNL. You know, that's provocative there.
Are those mostly, though, bought by women?
I guess. I mean, I really don't know, but...
Yeah, it's been a few years since I've been at his house. Actually, it's been more than a decade since I've been at his house, but I have a gay friend who used to love to keep, you know, hang those kind of calendars around, but I remember a stat that... One of the magazines that showed the Scott Brown kind of pictures was being more subscribed to by men than women. But again, it might be a Vanishing Hitchhiker kind of story. I don't remember. Debbie, thank you for the call. David in Minneapolis. Hey, David, thanks for listening to 950 AM. What's up?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to talk about the men and the women and that kind of thing.
Mm.
It's some of what I'm about to say may sound outrageous. It's not politically correct, but I think it's true. And for starters, I think a word that corresponds with slut for men is bum, or maybe loser, although that applies to both sexes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because, I mean, let's agree first that although justice is a good thing, and we want respect for men and for women equally,
mm-hmm.
men are not the same as women, and women are not the same as men. We are biologically different.
Right. Well, that was the point that I made earlier about the vast majority of people in prison are men. The vast majority of crimes are committed by men. Virtually all murders are committed by men. Men are typically the aggressors, and women are more often the victims. And this does have something to do with biology, and we have to acknowledge that.
Well, I want to go somewhere else with the biology, and that is that men are more interested in appearance than women are. Consequently, if a woman wants to attract a man, she's going to focus on how she looks. and this may sound stereotypical, but I think it's true, women are more interested in power than they are in appearance. So to be maybe 70% facetious or 50% facetious and a little bit true, if you want to know how a man should dress to attract a woman, how about if he tacks a $100 bill to his lapel?
Well, would you, you know, I might not disagree with you altogether if you were to change the word power to security.
Well, okay, I'll go there.
Because power leads to security, wealth leads to security.
The
wealthy, unattractive man and the beautiful woman, you know, the trophy wife is a cliche. I mean, you know, it's
well, it is a cliche, but there again, cliches are based on facts.
My point. My point.
The reason they're cliche is because
they're so common. Yeah. No, that was my point.
Exactly.
So, now we have a chicken and egg problem. Are women interested in security because, and men interested in appearances because biology makes us that way, or because we have a dysfunctional society that represses the rights and power of women so much so that they have that our society teaches them, or you know, whatever, that they have learned that they can use their appearance to get that security and that power that has been taken away by misogynistic men?
I don't think it's society. I think it's biology. And I'll give you a little story about myself. When I was 15 years old, I'm going steady with a girl. I mean, madly in love, my first love, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she would just beat me up, down, sideways verbally for talking to her chest instead of talking to her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm this 15-year-old kid, you know, and I'm just, right, I don't even know I'm doing it. It's like innate. The eyes are dropping to what we're interested in.
Right.
And I don't think society taught me that. It was just like human nature, and I have to learn that it's not respectful. Okay.
Right.
The face.
Right.
My phone is about to die, so I hang up on you.
Okay. Alrighty. Well, David, you made your point. Thank you very much for the call, and I appreciate it. And I think a lot of males can probably identify with that, with what you just said. Mike in Chicago, and you know, without malice, Mike in Chicago. Hey, the Taliban.
Yeah, two things. One thing first, I should say, I do believe women are attracted to power. If you look at politician scandals, a lot of the women are attracted to politicians because of the power. Now, that aside, the Taliban is the question that you pose, I don't think is going to happen. I believe that this country is much more liberally minded than one may believe. I think that if, perchance, anything was instituted enough to create a Taliban-like effect on females, that there would be enough blowback that it would change back.
That's
my opinion. I think sometimes I'm frustrated at the way politics happen to be less.
Well, I wonder
if
articles like Annie Rose's, are the leading edge of that blowback.
And it could be. I just believe that.
Because I'm seeing, you know, state after state where they're saying abstinence only, education, oh no, we, you know, 15 years old for the morning after pill, you know, this dress code here, this, you know, is misogyny is too strong a word. I'm struggling for a way to express this, but is the oppression of women reaching the point in the United States where women are starting to say enough already, and the damage that has been done? And I think that there's a very real possibility that the answer is yes. That said, I think we also have to acknowledge that there are biological differences. Coming up tomorrow, so who are the real terrorists? I'll have a rumble with conservative talk radio host Steve Malzberg. Plus, we'll have the best of the rest of the news along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag your it. Something like, you know, pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or free-don.com.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.